Welcome back to Tech Tuesday. Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Federal Communications Commission finalized historic internet neutrality rules during the Obama administration, paving the way for a system in which all web traffic is treated equally by internet service providers. Advocates believe those rules would create a more free and open internet. But things change. Big telecommunication companies fought against the free and open principle, and under a new FCC chair appointed by President Trump, a reversal of fortune for net neutrality advocates appears likely. Ars Technica senior IT reporter John Brodkin has been covering this issue. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the FCC enacted the new rules in 2015. Give us a thumbnail of what they did.
There are two major parts. First, they reclassified home internet and mobile internet service under Title II of the Communications Act, which gives them greater authority and allowed them to impose the net neutrality rules. Those net neutrality rules, the three core ones, prevent internet providers from blocking lawful traffic, from throttling it, and prohibit paid prioritization where a website or some other online service pays for faster access to customers. Mm-hmm. And that Title II classification, it also allowed them to impose some other requirements, such as new privacy rules and new disclosure rules.
So Title II of the Communications Act of 1934 was key to net neutrality because it allowed the FCC to treat the internet like a utility, right? They could regulate it.
Well, I mean, whether it's a utility is sort of controversial because they haven't imposed a lot of things like rate regulation and tariffing, and they haven't forced providers to share their networks with competitors. Mm-hmm. So they called it a light touch Title II, sort of like modernized. So all it does is impose the net neutrality rules and a few other things that are important, like privacy rules, which I mentioned.
The current FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, was an outspoken opponent of net neutrality back in the day. He was a member of the commission when
right.
the FCC enacted the new rules in 2015. Where does he come from and what were his objections?
Well, he says he supports an open internet, but mm-hmm. he opposes the net neutrality rules and the reclassification of internet providers. And he hasn't proposed any alternative other than simply overturning them. So, you know, until he proposes some kind of alternative, it just seems he opposes everything that's in place right now.
Why?
His view is that any sort of regulation prevents internet providers from investing in their networks. He thinks if they have to comply with a rule, that's less money they spend upgrading networks and bringing networks to new areas, which, you know, in turn would feeds into the biggest problem, which is that consumers just don't have enough choice, and in some cases don't have any choice for fast broadband.
Pardon me. How easy would it be for Ajit Pai to overturn the net neutrality rules that were established in 2015?
Well, if he goes through the same process, it would take a few months, the same process as they did last time, because it requires a notice of proposed rulemaking, taking public comment. But ultimately, he has a Republican majority as long as he's the chairman under President Trump. So, and his fellow Republican on the commission views net neutrality the same way. So it would take a few months, but ultimately they can do what they want.
What are some of the actions that Chairman Pai has taken since being appointed chairman of the FCC in January?
Well, he's taken some that were directly related to net neutrality and some that weren't. He's started the process of undoing the privacy rules, which means internet providers will be able to sell your web browsing history to advertisers without getting your consent. He ended a net neutrality investigation into zero rating, which is, it means exempting certain internet content from data caps. So that means we'll see more mobile carriers exempting their own video services from data caps while charging other video providers for those same exemptions. And that could make it harder for video services to compete against the network operators that operate their own video services. And another important one is they exempted ISPs with, 250,000 or fewer subscribers from new disclosure rules. And ultimately, that makes it harder for consumers to find out about hidden fees and the full cost of service before signing up for internet service. And, you know, the rationale behind ending those rules is that for small providers, it's too big of a burden to comply with them.
There's been criticisms on both sides of the aisle of the White House meddling too much in the affairs of the FCC. What was the case of that during the Obama administration?
Well, in, I think it was November 2014, President Obama made a public call on the FCC to do what they ultimately did to reclassify internet service and impose the net neutrality rules. And so the chairman at the time, Tom Wheeler, whether it was because of the White House or not, he says it wasn't because of the White House, ended up doing that. And Republicans in Congress, they spent a year or two investigating this and accusing the White House of meddling, because the FCC is supposed to be an independent agency that you know, operates without the White House telling it what to do.
Now, Ajit Pai met with President Trump recently for a while. Mm-hmm. They've not revealed what they talked about in a private session. Is it going to be a tit for a tat? Are the Democrats saying the same thing?
Basically, yeah. There was a hearing in front of the Senate Commerce Committee where Democrats were asking Chairman Pai what he discussed with President Trump. Pai declined to answer that. And now the Democrats have been pressing him a little bit more about that, trying to get a direct answer, not so much about net neutrality, but about whether Trump has ordered Pai to retaliate against media organizations that Trump doesn't like. And so we're waiting for a response from Pai on that.
Where does he come from? What is his background?
He was a lawyer for Verizon in the early 2000s and has held several roles in government since then. I think he worked for Congress, but then he's been a commissioner for the past 5 years. He was appointed by Obama, but the way it works is when there's, you know, the president appoints all the commissioners, but when a Democratic president appoints a Republican, he takes advice from the Senate Republican leadership. So Chairman Pai, he was commissioner for 5 years, and then when Donald Trump became president, he appointed him to be chairperson.
Critics of net neutrality claim that the rules were hurting, or are hurting, I guess because they're still in place, broadband network investment. What do they mean by broadband network investment for people who are listening and don't understand that? And is there any merit to that claim?
Oh, broadband network investment, I mean, basically it means investing in the hardware and the wires that allow companies to bring internet service to your home, and also in mobile networks, you know, big cell towers and things like that. I think that's undecided. I can't really say one way or the other if it's true or not. There was a survey by an economist named Hal Singer who looked at the top 12 ISPs, and he says investment is down. But then Senator Markey was pointing to U.S. Census figures of the telecommunications industry, which showed investment is up. You know, each side has their own figures, and they can't agree on which ones to use. Obviously, the Republicans use the ones that show it's going down, investment's going down, and Democrats use the ones that show investment's going up.
Republicans claim that net neutrality hurts high-tech healthcare that requires special access to the web. What are they talking about there?
Well, I wrote about a senator who said that net neutrality rules prevent healthcare services like remote diagnostics from getting fair treatment compared to like pornography sites. That, I think, is based on a misunderstanding. I don't think that senator read through the entire net neutrality order, because there are specific call-outs, exemptions where it gets a little technical, but you can have services that are sort of separate from the other online services delivered on the internet. They get isolated capacity. And so things like healthcare, remote diagnostics can be delivered with what I guess you could call prioritization without violating the net neutrality rules. He was saying that if you allow paid prioritization, then healthcare companies could pay for priority access, he seems to be concerned that pornography sites are going to get priority access, but if you allowed paid prioritization, then the porn sites could pay for it too. So mm-hmm. I don't know. It didn't seem like he totally understood all the rules mm-hmm. and the ramifications.
So, you know, you said it, once they announce a change to drop the new rules from 2015, that it could be about a two-month process. What kind of timeline are you anticipating on this? What are you paying attention to that'll give you some clues?
Well, there are a couple ways that they go about it. The FCC process would probably take more like 6 months, but the Congress, they could eliminate the net neutrality rules overnight. You know, they just because they can go say that, you know, internet service is no longer a Title II service. They can do that whenever they want. And now that a Republican is in the White House, you know, it's not likely to be vetoed. If it goes through the FCC, it's a little bit more slow paced. But in the meantime, they can just, you know, not enforce the rules.
And is there any indication that that's something that they'll do? Is just decide not to enforce it?
Well, with zero rating, they've already ended that investigation.
Okay.
In terms of the core rules of blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization, it hasn't really come up yet. Can't really say if they would enforce those rules.
Is there any concern that personnel at the FCC will be laid off, that there'll be a contraction in funding for the FCC?
I've heard some things about staffing short staff, but I honestly haven't looked into that too much, so I'm
okay.
Not sure.
John Brodkin, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's John Brodkin. He's a senior IT reporter at Ars Technica. Tech Tuesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last week, WikiLeaks made public 8,000 files of classified CIA data. The leak revealed numerous spy tactics, including how the agency can exploit security loopholes in phones and televisions. The WikiLeaks dump is just the latest example of government surveillance techniques, and it's reshaped questions about the privacy rights of U.S. citizens. Jennifer Granick wrote about these issues in her new book entitled American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care, and What to Do About It. She's director of civil liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society, and she joins us now by phone. Welcome, Jennifer Granick.
Thank you, Anne.
What was your initial reaction to the news about the WikiLeaks dump last week?
Well, it's always interesting to learn more about what the government is putting money into in terms of hacking capabilities. And I thought it was interesting to see that not just the FBI and the NSA, a domestic agency and a foreign agency, but also the Central Intelligence Agency have been making efforts to improve their hacking capabilities. I think the biggest news in some ways about the CIA documents is the fact that they were released in the first place and that they leaked, which raises real questions about the government's ability to keep classified information secret, you know, even after a number of different spy scandals.
You know, when I was listening to the reports day after day about this, I had to think that in a way, well, of course they're doing this. This is where the future is, right?
I think that's right. In my book, I write a lot about the NSA's tactics for getting information through hacking from some of the documents that Edward Snowden revealed. But it makes sense that the CIA is also developing its own capabilities, and also they're slightly different from the NSA's. They're really looking at things that they can implant when they have access to somebody's, say, hotel room or something like that, the kinds of things that the CIA specifically does overseas as opposed to some of the other agencies.
Should Americans be concerned that the CIA found security flaws in the products of U.S. companies and did not share them with those companies?
That's absolutely a concern. You know, we're very worried about the, and by we, I mean, you know, people who study civil liberties are very worried about the idea that the government has a mixed motive. On the one hand, government agencies are supposed to be there to help improve cybersecurity and protect the public from hackers and thieves. And on the other hand, the government has this spying mission where having vulnerabilities that agents can exploit is useful. So the government is, you know, kind of in a, they've got both desires going on at the same time. And the representation has been that in most cases, the vast majority of cases, the government will disclose the existence of vulnerabilities to companies so that companies can patch their software, fix their products, and thereby protect everybody. A lot of the stuff we saw in the CIA records were our old vulnerabilities or things that don't work anymore for older versions of phones or that sort of thing. But some people still use those phones. And there were some newer exploits that really should be patched.
Can you give us a sense of the breadth and depth of current domestic surveillance that's going on right now? How much do we really know about what's happening now?
Well, we're learning a lot, from these leaks, from reporting, and from the intelligence community realizing that in order to have legitimacy, they need to embrace more transparency and be more responsive to oversight committees and to Congress. But one of the things we really learned from Edward Snowden is how much surveillance that is targeted at foreigners and at the gathering of foreign intelligence impacts American privacy and gathers data about Americans. And that was a real surprise for even for experts.
And the breadth of that, is it, I was listening to an interview last week on NPR and they said, the experts said, well, I mean, it's safe to say that they're not. Snooping on you or me?
Well, I think, there's two things. There's capabilities, and the capabilities are pretty impressive, and then there's the actual practices. And I don't think that the, the NSA is trying to snoop on me. But as you can see in, some of the news about the Trump administration officials getting caught up in surveillance, when the agencies do surveillance on Russian officers or ambassadors, if you're doing surveillance to find out stuff like what's the price of oil likely to be next year, or, what is this foreign environmental movement doing? Americans talk to these people as part of business, as part of activism, because they're our relatives or our friends overseas. And when those people who are targeted for surveillance have information collected about them, and we're talking to those people, our information is collected too. And then the problem is, once that happens, Americans' information goes into a database that can be accessed by the FBI and other agencies without the usual safeguards that apply, like going to a judge and getting a warrant. They can just search through that information. So while we may not be targeted, our information can be opportunistically or incidentally collected as well. And then once that happens, then it's kind of a free-for-all.
We're talking about the implications of the latest dump by WikiLeaks, 8,000 files of classified CIA data. My guest is Jennifer Granick. She's director of civil liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Her new book is entitled American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care and What to Do About It. If you have a question or comment for Jennifer Granick, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Can we talk a little bit about capabilities and quotation marks? Marks right here. I know there's been an uptick in the purchase of 1984 by George Orwell, the whole idea of the Big Brother society. It feels like a lot of people are worried about that now. Is that a potential capability? Is that in the windshield now?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's something to be concerned about. As technology has revealed so much of our private information and has made it possible to collect so much information on us. So the government has, of all kinds of agencies have developed technology for surveillance and for hacking in order to gather that information. There's already a lot of surveillance going on. Domestically, we have facial recognition and, TV cameras and, collecting financial records. Foreign surveillance involves collecting our communications when we talk to foreigners. So there's these huge repositories of information that are being gathered. The public does not have a lot of oversight over how the information is subsequently used. And now, we have a change of, of leadership at the top, different people who are in charge of the offices that decide what the rules should be about how Americans' privacy is respected. And I think that there's, in the darkness and secrecy that surrounds surveillance, there is a lot of legitimate concern about how this information might be used. And you can really see it now with things like people's experience crossing the border. There are so many stories now of Americans crossing the border who are having their social media passwords taken, their cell phones searched, laptop searches, being pulled over and having, being questioned. A lot of people who, all around the country who live in different communities have had this experience with local police departments, too. So it's really a legitimate concern and one that I think is not going to go away until we have more transparency, more information, and more oversight to ensure that people's privacy rights are protected and that when they're not, when something goes wrong, that there's some kind of ramifications or punishment so that, the rules and the civil rights are enforced.
I have heard about the laptop searches and the smartphone searches and the social media searches. Is that, like, social media, you can't really, if... It depends on whether you're a friend or not, but is all of that legal?
For the government to take that information and search it?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think what the government would say is, well, we're just asking and people are giving us this information, so it's consent, and so we're allowed to do it. But I think anybody who's ever been pulled over by a police officer or questioned at the border knows that it's not entirely voluntary. There's an amount of coercion there when you're told that you need to give over this information or you're not going to make your next plane or be allowed out of the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, well, do they need to get a warrant or have some kind of suspicion
to
get this information from people? The general rule is at the border is that it's a warrant-free zone. They don't usually need to have, officials don't usually need to have a search warrant to conduct searches or seizures at the border. But that doesn't mean that it's a civil liberties free zone either. You may need to have some kind of reasonable suspicion to have some basis for actually asking people to gather this information. And race or national origin is not a good reason. That's a discriminatory and improper reason. I know that there are Senator Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, has introduced a bill to stop agents from asking people for their social media passwords and conducting these kinds of overbroad searches. And I think there really is a role for Congress to play here to say, this is not what we're about. This is not how we treat Americans. And there's real dangers from having random agents go through your private information, take your password, and that sort of thing.
You've written that preventing terrorism is the justification for massive spying, but that these broad surveillance techniques that we're talking about don't necessarily do a good job of preventing terrorist attacks. What's your argument there?
Well, there's a real faith or ideology that if we collect all the dots, then we'll be able to connect all the dots and that we can turn information into intelligence. But if you look at the examples of where there's been terrorist attacks in the United States, the problem wasn't that we didn't have information. It was that we didn't understand the information that we have. And the documents, the Snowden documents, reveal a lot of concern within the National Security Agency about having actually too much information and not being able to tell what's really worth paying attention to because you have so much data on so many people. It's like there's a needle in the haystack, and terrorism really is a needle in the haystack. It's very rare. You have a needle in the haystack, and the solution isn't to collect more hay. It's to focus on the needles. But what we're doing, what mass surveillance is it's just collecting more hay. And it actually, you know, puts us at more risk as opposed to helping us, you know, identify the dangerous people and focusing on them.
What's your sense about how interested people are in protecting their privacy from this mass surveillance versus their fears about terrorism?
You know, I think that people are quite afraid of terrorism, and certainly, you know, the news coverage encourages that fear, even though it's not that rational, because if you look at the instances of terrorism versus other things, you know, you're more likely to die falling off a ladder, and you're far more likely to die from a car. And yet, you know, we accept cars into our lives and we regulate them and we, you know, sort of we accept them in our daily existence. So I think there's a lot of fear about terrorism. I think that there's been less fear about privacy because I think a lot of people feel, as you said, Anne, in the beginning, that, you know, nobody's listening to me. Nobody's targeting me. But I think as people understand that modern surveillance is massive surveillance and that we, you know, innocent people get caught up, and as we start to see that this information is being used not against, you know, criminals and potential terrorists, but also against our fellow Americans because of their religion or their country of origin or because of their political activities, that people begin to realize, you know what, this actually is a really scary and dangerous practice, this surveillance. And in order for us to be free and to be Americans, to practice our religion, to be political, we need to have privacy. And so I think people are beginning to come around and understand the political value and the democratic value of having limited government access to our private information.
So right now we have a needle in the haystack when it comes to finding terrorist activity, in all this data. But eventually they'll come up with an algorithm, and if they can do it to find that, they can do it to suss out all kinds of other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, I live in Silicon Valley, so there's just such faith in computer technology as being able to solve all of, you know, our problems. But the problem is, if you understand algorithms and statistics, that's not going to happen. And the reason is, you know, there's always going to be false positives. And, you know, these false, when the phenomenon that you're trying to measure, in this case terrorism, is fleetingly rare, the false positives are going to overwhelm the real positives. And you're going to end up with something like what we have with the no-fly list, where you have, you know, a million people on it, and a tiny fraction of which are actually dangerous. You're going to end up with a ton of leads that are going to distract from the real from the real people that we should be paying attention to. And I think if you look at statistics and you look at experience, it says that the best way to find the few terrorists that, you know, we have are going to be from, you know, when their parents call and say something's wrong with my son, or when you have people who are communicating with known terrorists about particular plots or that sort of thing. No algorithm is ever going to be able to solve that problem just as a matter of statistical science.
So even with the best of intentions, people would be swept up in something that has nothing to do with them. Likewise, it could happen with the worst of intentions when you start to try to manipulate all this data.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote this book, you know, with the and did this analysis, assuming, you know, the best of intentions on the part of the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. I, you know, that the goal was really to try to keep the United States safe, viewed through the narrow prism that the intelligence community has, because they're just part of the government. There's other things and other values that we have in society beyond intelligence collection. But without question, if these technologies and these capabilities are in the hands of somebody who does not have the best interests of American citizens at heart and is set about to, you know, deport people, to deny health care, to these tools are incredibly dangerous in the hands of a malicious organization.
How does the knowledge that you're being surveilled change behavior? What do we know about that?
Well, there's a lot of social science done on this to see whether people are change when they think somebody's watching. And what they've shown is that people even change not just what they do and not just what they say, but even what they're willing to think, through the kinds of things people are willing to read or to look at if they think somebody's watching. You know, we really are limited in being our fullest, most honest selves when we think somebody is looking over our shoulder. I think teenagers really understand this, you know, that they need to have private time away from their parents in order to figure out who they are. And I think there's something that's really true about that for everybody.
It's easier to give power than to take it away. What are the possibilities for reforming current laws and adding checks to the intelligence community's data collection? A lot has changed, right, since 2001.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great question. But I think we've shown that we are able to do reform. After Edward Snowden's documents revealed that the NSA and FBI were bulk collecting Americans' phone calling records, we passed a law, the USA Freedom Act, which basically ended that practice and ended the bulk collection of that kind of data. We are going to have another opportunity like that this year, where a law that enables the collection of the contents of our emails, instant messages, and phone calls with foreigners, where the foreigners are the targets. That law is expiring at the end of 2017. It's called Section 702, and Congress has to either renew it, reform it, or let it lapse. And so this is a real opportunity for Americans to fix the problems with that law and the ways in which it fails to protect people's privacy. So I think that I feel very optimistic that we have identified problems with surveillance that happened in secret, and now that it's been revealed, and that there is a appetite and an opportunity to reform those programs and make them much more narrowly targeted at national security, as opposed to the kind of broad surveillance that sucks a lot of Americans in and then has that data capable for repurposing for all kinds of uses without any demonstration of suspicion. We can end that this year.
And what about the courts and their interpretation of all of this? How's that playing out?
You know, in the public courts, so there's a secretive foreign intelligence surveillance court that has not always had a great track record in critically looking at and regulating these spying programs. Mm-hmm. But once the information is considered by regular public courts, we've seen much better legal analysis and much more critical view of these surveillance programs. So the problem is that under the Obama administration, there were a lot of legal arguments made to try to keep challenges to massive surveillance out of the public courts. And so advocates are still trying to overcome that and get courts to really play their role, their judicial role, and consider it. But I think once that happens, the courts have been, far more critical in issuing much more thoughtful rulings about, whether this kind of surveillance violates our constitutional rights under the Fourth Amendment and whether it's even, in accord with the rule of law. Did Congress really intend to have this massive surveillance when it passed these statutes?
Jennifer Granick, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for the conversation, Ann.
Jennifer Granick, Director of Civil Liberties at the Stanford Center for Internet and Society. Her new book is entitled American Spies, Modern Surveillance, Why You Should Care, and What to Do About It. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Smart, wearable technology from smartwatches to smart glasses is supposed to free us from those bulky smartphones. But we pay the price in awkward and clunky. Incorporating smart connectivity into our clothing may be part of the solution. Levi's and Google have collaborated on such a product, merging a version of the iconic jean jacket with tech. Joining us to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
I was worried I might not get you today because of the snowstorm, but you said no, you just had an ice storm.
Yeah, no, it is still very white outside, but just not the kind you go to play in.
Shiny white. Conductive fiber has been woven into the material of this jacket that's being produced by Levi's and Google. What does that do?
So it gives you kind of basic navigation control over your phone. You have a patch on the jacket that doesn't really look any different from the rest of the jacket when you're looking at it, but has a slightly different texture to it when you run your fingers over it. And, you have the ability to swipe up and down and left and right for kind of basic commands that are built into the jacket itself that relay those commands over to the phone. So, for example, if you are listening to music, you can, swipe left or right to change tracks or to up and down to pause and play. That extends to GPS navigation and a whole bunch of other things that are really kind of actions inside of applications.
The jacket can be washed, but there's a Bluetooth cuff link that can't, and that's how it connects to the smartphone?
Right. It's a simple thing that connects just on the inside of the sleeve. It really kind of stays out of the way. It's not particularly heavy or anything. It has a small battery in it that powers everything and handles the transmission. And so you take this thing out when you're going to put it in the wash, but the rest of the time it will remain connected to the jacket.
So just everyday life, you already mentioned how you can change the volume and pause or whatever, music on your smartphone or that kind of a thing. But what else?
A big part of this is a lot of those just kind of simple interactions. The design for the jacket in particular is for like a commuter riding a bike on a regular basis. Someone who's who does most of their traveling on something like a bike. When you have text messages that come in, you can swipe to hear text messages as they're played. It's really any kind of interaction that, when you look down at your phone, you can handle with a single button press or, a continuous, gesture in one way or another. If you have an application running in the background, setting the next set of directions from GPS or, if you have, I guess it would work with, they haven't actually demonstrated this, but I guess it would work with the Audible recipe systems, like apps that'll read, recipes for cooking. Where you'd be able to kind of swipe to the next step. It would suppose to work with that as well.
And if you're on your bike and you have Bluetooth, you could just answer your phone that way too?
Right. Yeah. If, the call would come in so it really would depend on, how you have everything set up. If the phone is kind of mounted on your handlebars and you can look down at it, it really ends up being a question of is it more convenient or safer to kind of reach down and touch the phone? Mm-hmm. Or to kind of make this brief gesture on the side of the jacket.
Okay, is it cool looking?
It looks exactly like a jean jacket. It is indistinguishable from any other jacket in Levi's line.
And is it indistinguishable when it comes to the cost? Because Levi's isn't cheap to begin with.
Levi's is not cheap to begin with, and the jacket that this is styled off of is already not a cheap jacket. There's about a $50 difference between you know, kind of a standard commuter jacket from Levi and this jacket, which is going to be $350 when it goes on sale.
Wow.
Like I said, that's about $50 more than what Levi normally charges for this style of jacket.
Okay. And do you, you know, it's not cheap, but you're right. $50, if you can afford a $300 jacket, why not $350 for connectivity if that's important to you? We've been talking about smart clothes for a long time now. Do you think, I mean, obviously, if Levi and Google are investing in it, then they must have done some research that says people want it.
This is a big part of, you know, Google's kind of, you know, in development lab. This is something that Google and has, you know, they reached out specifically to Levi to solve this problem. They started 2 years ago when they initially announced that they were going to try and do something, you know, with fabric and have that work. And so this has been kind of 2 years in the making, and we're not going to see these until the fall. So it's actually going to be closer to 3 years from when they originally made this announcement to when they're actually available to people. And I really think that the whole goal here is to make sure that these are able to be used kind of safely in environments that, you know, Google and Levi haven't really planned before they move on to kind of the next step with this. And I've gotten a couple of weird looks when I've talked about this with colleagues, but, you know, having this in a jacket is really kind of nice. I kind of feel like I would like this on a pant leg.
Okay, I'm giving you a weird look.
Know, yeah, well, so like, you know, if I'm seated somewhere or if I'm driving or something like that, I feel like, you know, that would be like that gesture somewhere like on my kneecap or something.
Huh.
Although in a public place, I think that would
look weird.
Look even more awkward than kind of doodling on the side of your jacket with your fingers. So either way, there's going to be kind of a little bit of some social confusion, regardless of where they put, you know, this tactile bit of fabric in the future.
Yeah, why is that guy tapping his knee really fast over there?
That's right.
At the food court, right? Okay. More and more people are cutting the cord, ditching cable, switching to streaming services. Making this happen is getting easier than ever, and there's lots of options, right?
There are a ton of options. It was actually really surprising, you know, how many options are available and you know, kind of what they're built into now. We have smart TVs that are becoming significantly less expensive, that are having a lot of these, not just having a lot of the apps built into them, but are much smarter about knowing what it is that you're connecting to the television, which I think in many ways can be better for, you know, different users. You know, kind of adapting to new technology. Mm-hmm. When you go to change kind of the inputs on your television, everything always has, you know, that kind of really technical HDMI 1, HDMI 2, HDMI 3.
Right.
But there are a lot of smarter televisions now where you plug in a Chromecast or a Roku box or an Apple TV or something like that. And all three of these are capable of, you know, streaming these kind of cord cutting solutions. But the thing that's important is that when you're plugging these in, instead of saying, you know, HDMI 2, it'll actually say, you know, Roku or, you know, PlayStation View or something like that, where it understands that you plugged in something other than, you know, just kind of a generic cable box. And so, you know, I felt like that was an important first step, was making sure that, you know, it's easy to see that, you know, this is the thing that I go to on my television specifically for, you know, my television, whereas that used to be, you know, channel 3, and then it used to be whatever the first input was on your television. And now it's easier to kind of label these experiences so that you can pick the one that you want and have it be, you know, kind of the dominant experience on the television, because it doesn't really matter which one of these hardware options you go with. The important thing when it comes to these cord cutting services are the apps themselves. And the apps themselves, one of the biggest things that we've seen, DirecTV has one now. There's a new service that's going to be coming out later this year from Google that's using YouTube as a streaming service. PlayStation has an option, and Sling TV has an option as well. And all four of these apps, the core focus there is just being available on every piece of hardware imaginable, so that when you say, I want to pay maybe $30 a month for these 15 channels and the ability to record television when I want, those services are available instead of, you know, kind of the monthly cable bill that gets built into, you know, kind of your internet bundle and things like that. And so in areas where that ends up being a possibility, you end up, you know, paying considerably less as long as you're able to get the channels that you want.
You know, earlier when you were talking about this, I think you hesitated. You wanted to say making it work so that people like Ann Fisher can use it?
No, you know, it was when I said that, I was really people. I always, my default for this kind of stuff is my sister.
Okay.
She is, you know, an incredibly intelligent individual and, you know, very talented at what she does, but has never been very technical. And for someone like me, it's always good to kind of, you know, talk to her about stuff and be like, what do you think about this thing? And if she doesn't understand it at all, then I realize that, you know, I have kind of a job to do as far as explaining it to her and showing her how that works. And it is kind of a nervous thing when you think about cutting the cord, because for a lot of homes, you know, having that, there's only ever been one place to get your television, you know, is from the cable company. And there have been a couple of different cable company options, but the idea that you could just pay, you know, PlayStation, Sony, for a monthly service that would give you television over the internet, and it's not an illegal thing. it's built to do this, is really kind of a foreign concept to a lot of people who are not overly technical.
Some people are using antennas too, in addition to all of this, right?
Right. So, you know, this is, you know, our broadcast television still very much exists in a digital format. And a lot of these smarter kind of boxes that you plug into your television are capable of receiving the digital over-the-air signals with just a simple tuner and kind of building it into the existing, you know, set of apps that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Android TV is really good at this in particular. It's a box called the NVIDIA Shield TV, where you can plug the you know, just a regular TV tuner into the box, and that broadcast television gets treated like an app sitting right next to Netflix and Hulu and apps like that, so that you can go and enjoy those channels, you know, with the same ease that you would everything else in that service, instead of having to jump to another input just for those handful of channels that you would get digitally.
One thing that might be helpful to me in controlling a lot of this stuff is the universal remote. They're getting better, right?
Universal remotes are always getting better. Logitech has gotten very, very good at, you know, releasing remotes that are not just, you know, pointing at the television and pressing a button, but also, you know, being aware that there are other apps being used on the television and kind of working with those apps to control things. And then you have people like me who would rather just completely remove the remote control and do everything from my phone, because I already have my phone in my hand because I have problems and should probably talk to a therapist. but through the phone, you know, I have the Chromecast application, where every single app that I have on my phone, from YouTube to Netflix to all of these streaming apps that you know, that can stream regular television, have a Chromecast button on them. So instead of, you know, thinking about the TV guide living on the television, where I have to go and kind of thumb through until I find something that I want, you know, all of that information is on my phone. And when I find the thing that I want, I just press the button and it kind of flings it at the television.
I like that. Hey, just, we only have a couple minutes left. Verizon must be competing with all of this. It has a new streaming deal to win over new customers, probably people who like the idea of what you're talking about right now. If you use Verizon for both cable and phone services, you can watch TV on your phone without running down your data usage, right? This is appealing to a lot of people now.
Yeah, this is really great, and at the same time, super terrible for consumers. You know, Verizon is following in the footsteps of T-Mobile now that they know that they can get away with it, and are streaming Verizon's Fios mobile app data, which is, you know, television from the Fios service, over your Verizon wireless connection without charging you any data. So, you know, if you decide to use the Fios TV app to you know, stream live channels that are available there, it doesn't count against your monthly data allotment in any way.
So why is this bad for consumers? 1 minute.
So this was something that T-Mobile started a while ago, and it brought up a lot of questions regarding net neutrality that the FCC was investigating and trying to find ways to kind of, you know, understand how this worked and whether or not it was anti-competitive. But we have this new FCC chairperson now, who has been appointed for quite some time by our new administration. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that he did when he came to office was drop that investigation entirely.
That's right. We talked about that earlier in the program. Listeners, if you want to listen to that, check it out on WOSU.org/allsides. Russell Holly, we're out of time today. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's been Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for listening.